A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 20, 1987, in the series, The Mystery of God's Grace, entitled, Worship, the Context of Encounter and Calling. The scripture readings are Isaiah 6, verses 1 through 8, and Revelation 1, verses 9 through 19. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
A former great Archbishop of Canterbury described worship this way. To worship is to quicken the conscience by the holiness of God. To feed the mind with the truth of God, to purge the imagination by the beauty of God, to open the heart to the love of God, to devote the will to the purpose of God. That statement has lived on because it would be hard to find a more concise and inclusive description of what worship is all about. The conscience quickened by the holiness of God, the mind fed with the truth of God, the imagination purged by the beauty of God, the heart opened to the love of God, the will devoted to the purpose of God. And particularly that last aspect of worship is the focus this morning as we continue our series on the mystery of God's sovereign grace, recognizing worship as the context for an encounter with God and the calling of God to our lives, the calling to vocation. It is in the context of worship that we are encountered by God. And it is in that gracious encounter that we hear God's call that sends us forth. God's sovereign grace is a mystery. We have been stressing in these weeks that God has a plan and a purpose. And because God is God, that is a sovereign plan and purpose. That is, God's plan will prevail. We can rest in that. God's plan will prevail. And it's a gracious plan. It is for our salvation and for our well-being. And so we can affirm that plan and know that it is our good, for our good. God is our ally, not our adversary. And so that it is not as though our humanity is shrunken somehow by the affirmation of the sovereignty of God, but rather we have come to see that it is precisely through the authentic expression of our humanity that the plan and purpose of God is executed, that heaven and earth are bound together through the communion of God with His people and the communication of God's people with God, that heaven and earth are bound together in that the human person freely and responsively offers himself to become the instrument for the effecting of the plan and purpose of God. And we have looked at that not through some kind of abstract theological or philosophical discussion, but rather we've looked at it in terms of story, as the Bible tells stories. And the truth becomes clear from the story of Esther and of Joseph and of Nehemiah and of Abraham. We have seen how the purpose and plan of God is affected through the free and responsible offering of the human person to become the instrument for the purpose of God. History is the arena in which the plan and purpose of God develops, unfolds. And the drama of history is the drama of that intertwining of the divine and the human, of heaven and earth, so that God's sovereign, gracious plan will prevail. Admittedly to us, that is a mystery, but a wonderful mystery in which we can rest ourselves and in which, upon which we can build our hope. Now I want to say this morning that that mystery comes to be revealed to us in the context of worship. That it is in a setting like this, with folks like us gathered as we are, consciously and intentionally placed in the presence of God, that we are most likely to be encountered by that overwhelming grace and to hear the call, "Whom will I send? Who will go?" And in that context, we will be ready to respond as did Isaiah, "Here am I, send me." Recognizing that worship is a broad term. It happens with the individual person alone, privately, in the presence of God. And really, our every day ought to have some window somewhere when we are consciously in the presence of God alone. Worship can happen when a group of believers gathers together and together in the name of Jesus Christ are present to God. Worship can happen in the enthusiastic and emotional outburst of spontaneity of a charismatic gathering where there is joy and chaos. And worship happens when the people of God are gathered, are assembled in a structured celebration of worship such as this, where there is music and cymbal, where there is color and pageantry, where the word is heard through the liturgy, and where the people of God, gathered consciously in the presence of God, position themselves to be encountered and to respond to the call of God. Worship occurs in private and corporately and in all of those situations, but this morning I'm going to do again as I've done in past weeks, and that is to just let the story be told, and consequently the story will speak to one of those occasions of formal worship of the people of God in a highly structured situation in the environment which was particularly set apart for worship, where the people of God offered themselves to praise Him and to value Him and to ascribe to Him the worth that they sensed from Him. Isaiah felt his call to the prophetic office in an overwhelming experience of worship in one of the great state occasions of worship in the people of Israel and Judah. We don't know exactly what that occasion was, but we know that sometime in the year 742, because that's the year that King Uzziah died, that Isaiah was in that formal worship setting. He was standing somewhere between the porch of the temple and the altar, looking through the great soaring pillars. And as he was in the midst of the liturgy, which included symbol and music and color and pageantry and the priesthood as he was gathered in that setting with the people of God in the formal liturgy and the worship of God. Suddenly, it was as though Isaiah was all alone. Although he was in the midst of God's people, it was as though there was no one but God and him. And he speaks of the vision that he received in that context. The vision described in the sixth chapter of his prophecy, which in that autobiographical paragraph gives us the foundation and the basis for that strong ministry that was his. He saw the Lord high and lifted up. He saw the King. He says the temple was filled with smoke. The foundations shook. He saw the messengers, the creatures of God, the unearthly, heavenly creatures of God ministering around the throne. No face is described, but the sweeping garment and the smoke of the presence that spoke of presence and power. The rumbling of the foundations pointing to the power and the presence of the living God who was confronting, encountering Isaiah in that moment. And in the presence of that vision, the wonder and glory of the holiness of God, Isaiah said, "Oh my goodness, I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." The gulf between God and the human person, the gulf between heaven and earth, seemed to be an unbridgeable gulf. There was immediately the recognition that his eyes had beheld what no human eyes could behold. He said, "I am done for." And then the gracious movement of God, who in the first place had encountered him, comes now with the ministering angel, the coal from off the altar, touching his lips, saying, "I have cleansed you. This has touched your lips. You are purified." Graciously cleansed, consecrated, and now able to be in the presence of God, after which he heard the voice saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" To which, in that sense of being totally overwhelmed, in that sense of being graced and cleansed, he responded simply, "Here am I. Send me." Worship is the context for the encounter and the calling of God. If we are to encounter God and be encountered by God, if we are to hear God's call and respond to that call, it will happen in the context of worship. It will happen sometimes when we are all alone. It will happen often when we are gathered together as the people of God in that formal setting, in that environment set apart for the worship of God, in the midst of the structured liturgy of the service, through the music, through the prayers, through the anthems, through the movement, through the color, through the imagery, through the symbolism, through the proclamation of the word. Somehow or other, in that structured experience, we are most likely to be encountered by the gracious God, called to his service, and offer ourselves to be available for the effecting of his plan and purpose. That response on our part will be genuine response. It will be elicited from us, but it will be truly our own. It will be the consequence of the initiating grace of God. It will be the God who comes to us, but it will be our response. We will we will be able to say nothing else than, "Here am I, send me." It will be natural, it will be normal. Sometimes the hesitancy, "Oh Lord, how could I? Who am I that I should hear this call to such service?" But finally, in the encounter with God, in the context of worship, we will experience that enabling grace that will enable us to say, "Here am I, send me." Worship is the context in which we are most likely to be encountered and to hear the call of God. Worship, said Archbishop Temple, is to quicken the conscience by the holiness of God. Isaiah knew immediately. His spontaneous response was, "Woe is me, I am undone." He experienced the gracious cleansing and consecrating of God. But his conscience had been sensitized to feed the mind with the truth of God, to have some grasp of who God is and what He is about, to purge the imagination by the beauty of God, to open the heart to the love of God, and finally to devote the will to the purpose of God. It is in the context of worship that those really marvelous things happen to us. It is only, dare I say it, it is only in the context of worship where we are lifted out of ourselves, where we are consciously present to the one who is beyond us. It is only in that context, I believe, that the very best will be lifted out of us, drawn forth from us, that our lives will be purified and cleansed and be put together and made whole, and we'll find the fulfillment of a purposeful human existence by responding to the call of God to be the instrument for the effecting of His purpose. It is in worship that all that happens. And it is worship about which I would reflect with you for just a few moments this morning. And I want you to recognize the difficulty with which I do this. Because to speak of worship is not the same thing as worshiping. Right now, some of you at least, I say optimistically, have your minds engaged, not for the constant flow of my words. I am under no illusion about that. You will move in and out of attention. You will be with me for a moment and slip out and come back in. And it could well be that you will leave and not know one thing that I said. But hopefully, minds will be engaged to the extent that we are together in this discussion. But the mind is engaged. At this moment, the mind is engaged. And what I must say is that the encounter of God is not accessible to the engagement of the mind. That's my frustration. The problem I face when I talk about worship is that to discuss worship is not to worship. To be engaged rationally in discussion is good and positive, but it is not the same kind of thing that Isaiah was describing. It probably could happen more easily, more likely this morning, when Ruth sings from the psalm, that wonderful anthem. It probably could happen more easily this morning when the organ rolls with mighty power so that there are goosebumps and goosebumps on goosebumps running up and down our spine. The frustration to me is that it is my function to speak reasonably to you, to speak truthfully to you, but to know that in that discussion and in that reasonable discourse, it is not likely that the experience of the presence of God will be felt. It is important, and I do not downplay it, but I can't make worship happen in terms of encounter. To speak of it is not the same thing as to experience it. God reveals Himself. God makes Himself known. He is not at my disposal. He is not for me to manipulate. I cannot with any eloquence or persuasion or reasonable power lift aside the veil, cause the sanctuary to fill with smoke, to cause the train of the Almighty to wisp before our eyes. That's where I am, and that's where we are. To speak about it is not the same thing as to experience it. And the corollary of that, or the other side of the coin, is that God reveals Himself not against our mind, not in spite of our mind, but much deeper than our mind. What we're talking about, if we use Isaiah as our model, is a revelation of God beneath the rational, comprehensive powers of the prophet. What we need to feel is God in the gut. And I don't know how to do that. God must do that. And God does do that. Now and then, here and there, with this one or that one. How do you describe a lump in the throat? How do you describe a tear that trickles down the cheek unbidden? How do you describe the sensations that cause goose flesh to rise? But thank God, although He is not at my disposal, nor at your disposal, He graciously reveals Himself now and again, here and there, to this one or to that one. It is in the context of worship that I am most likely to be encountered by that good and gracious God. And if that revelation of God comes to me beneath my rational capability, if it is not available to my mind as mind, but must address me in my whole person, then you can see how necessary it is that the liturgy, the service, the whole experience be so put together that the whole person may be addressed. The weakness, let me start out with the strength of the tradition from which we stem, is that there has been clarity of understanding of the revelation of God through His Word. There has been an understanding of the faith, an intellectual grasp, so that there has been clarity. And the clarity of that truth is a very great value. But the weakness of the tradition from which we stem is that we have gotten blocked at the intellectual level. The sermon has been the centerpiece, and the sermon is precisely that element of the worship that addresses the mind. And the address to the mind is precisely not the place where one is most likely to be encountered beneath the rational, beneath the reason, below the head. It is for that reason that we work very hard here to address every part of the person through every means available. It is for that reason here that with intention, with deliberateness, with care, and with prayer, we put every element of the worship into the service in a particular order, in order to effect a particular effect, in order that somewhere through the whole, one here, one there, now and again, if even for one element of worship, will have the possibility of a lump in the throat or a tear in the cheek or goose flesh, wherever it may arise. Because it is in music and dancing, in color and symbol, in liturgy, in prayer, in proclamation, that we are placing ourselves in the context where just maybe God will take a hold of us and touch us in the core of our being, through the stretching of the mind, through the moving of the emotion, through the portrait painted on the pages of the imagination, through aesthetic sense, through rational sense, through feeling capacity, that all of it, as we come totally together to open ourselves, our whole being to God, that just maybe the hour will not pass without some sense of the touch of grace. Worship is the context for encounter and calling. It is out of this experience that we have the greatest possibility of seeing His face, of knowing His grace. I wish I had a fish for every fisherman who has told me how wonderful it is to worship on the water. I believe that. I wish I had a hole in one for every golfer who has told me about the encounter of the Almighty after a mighty drive on Sunday morning. I believe that. But I also know that if I am serious about having my conscience purified by the holiness of God, my mind fed with the truth of God, my imagination purged by the beauty of God, my heart filled with the love of God, my will devoted to the purpose of God, it is far more likely that he's got a shot at me here than any other place. There is no legal necessity of being here. But John was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day in exile in Patmos. And he heard a voice and he saw a vision of Jesus. Read the vision again. Note the symbolism, note the imagery, the powerful vision of John, the risen Christ, meeting him in exile on Patmos, there for the testimony of Jesus. And it didn't happen on Monday, and it didn't happen on the sea, and it didn't happen on the golf course. It happened in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. I know that I'm not normal. But I stand before you, before God, to say that this hour is the passion of my life. For myself. And, oh my people, for you. Whom shall I send? Who will go for me? Obvious.